we do know that taking action is empowering, that feeling of helplessness, that, you know, as physicians, we've seen people who regress and are unable to take the bull by the horns, and we really have to help them because they don't make good decisions when they've regressed. But it's when we finally tackle a problem that the empowering sense begins to grow and brings us together with others who, because of the collective, and we're social animals, when we're together with others who are like-minded, that's where we can reach our ascendancy and really bring the noblest, the noble angels in ourselves to the fore.
Welcome, I'm David Castro, board member of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows. Today, we're excited to continue a series of national dialogues, engaging leaders at the frontiers of social justice. This conversation today continues our series on the climate crisis, which now threatens not only human communities around the world, but also the entire ecosystems that support life on Earth. Our series is called Talk That Walks. Our program convenes frontline leaders at the critical place where thought and research becomes change. The leaders in today's conversation inhabit that transition point where experience and research and insight take flight as impactful action. We want to thank the Americana Foundation for supporting today's conversation. To learn more about the vision and mission of the Alliance, visit us on the web at allianceofleadershipfellows.org. I'm so excited today to welcome Dr. Lisa Van Susteren and David Intercasso. Lisa is a general and forensic psychiatrist in Washington, D.C. She's an expert on the physical and psychological impacts of climate change. During her career, she served as a clinical associate professor of psychology and behavioral sciences at George Washington University, and she's also been a consultant to the executive branch of the U.S. government. In 2011, she co-authored an important article, The Psychological Effects of Global Warming on the U.S., Why the U.S. Mental Health System is Not Prepared. Lisa is a frequent contributor on television, radio, and in print media. Her most recent book, Emotional Inflammation, Discover Your Triggers and Reclaim Your Equilibrium During Anxious Times, was published in 2020. Among her many leadership roles, Lisa is the co-founder of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance, a professional group dedicated to promoting awareness and action on climate from a mental health perspective. David Intercasso is a longtime DC-based healthcare, environmental, and public policy researcher. He's worked for the U.S. House Majority Leader at the Department of Health and Human Services, for the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, and for the Agency for Healthcare Research and Policy. He's advised many clients, including the American Public Health Association and the United Health Group. His work over the past several years has focused exclusively on federal policy reform in the arena of healthcare issues related to the climate crisis. David is also a Kellogg Foundation Fellow. That's an experience we share. And we recently elected him as a Fellow of the Alliance. I'd like to focus our conversation today on the healthcare system. But before we get into that exchange, I'd like to just spend a few minutes establishing the context. We're here in the spring of 2023 with a lot of key information from the March report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the findings are really not good. What have we learned? And I'll toss that question to you, David.
Thank you, David. Thanks for the invitation, Lise. Appreciate your being here as well. I want to compliment Lise because she's one of the few clinicians who works this subject, and that's understated. So, David, you mentioned the UN under its 1992 treaty, UNFCCC, United Nations Framework on Climate Change, Convention on Climate Change. This intergovernmental panel puts out these assessments every 4 to 7 years. The latest, the sixth assessment cycle, is just formally completed March 20th with this summary report to policymakers. And I'll just read one or two sentences from that 38-odd page IPCC summary, which is termed the last warning informally, because the next report will not be out until likely the beginning of the next decade. So here are the two sentences. there is a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. The choices and actions implemented in this decade will have impacts now and for thousands of years. Close quote. So where we are relative to the climate, however you want to term it, crisis, disaster, breakdown, et cetera, since the UN created the FCCC, over the last 30 years, we've emitted more carbon emissions or pollutions than we have in the previous, or we have in the previous 240 years of the Industrial Revolution. Presently, globally, we emit about 40 billion tons of term CO2e, meaning a carbon dioxide equivalents, which include, of course, methane, nitrous oxide, and other greenhouse gases. The U.S. is, after China, produces the most annual greenhouse gas emissions, about 15%, although, depending on how you calculate it, will go down in history more than likely, assuming China doesn't catch up, as the greatest carbon polluter in history, somewhere between 25 and 40%, the higher percentage if you calculate on a per capita basis, historical greenhouse gas emissions. Oddly, since we're all of 4% of the world's population, to reinforce the per cap reality. Right now, probably where the Paris Accord 2015 agreement, the preferred limit was to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, if not to 2 degrees. Currently, we're on track to significantly overshoot both those warming degree amounts, to the extent that on the presently, we're on track for the Earth to warm on average at about 3 degrees Celsius. I should say warming is uneven. So at the poles, it's somewhere between 4 to 7 times faster. In fact, the US is global warming average is about 1.2, the US is 1.4. The real problem with all this, this will be my last point on this, is the real problem is we're very close to engaging what are called feedback loops or tipping points. There are approximately 40 odd of these biogeophysical feedback loops, some of which we may have already engaged. And the problem is that once a sufficient number of these are engaged, then we've reached this point of irreversible or runaway warming. Meaning even if we stop completely emitting any gas, greenhouse gases, it wouldn't matter because these feedback loops, the warm will just continue to warm uncontrollably. This has been termed a hothouse Earth. The effect has been given that term. And we're getting very close to that, somewhere between, it's unclear, the science isn't very exact or well understood, but we've probably engaged a few of these feedback loops. We get north of 1.5, get closer to 2, we'll engage more, and then it becomes very problematic, particularly because the technology for carbon capture and storage, CCS or NET, negative emissions technology, is not financially viable on any sort of significant scale. So that is the real worry. The bottom line is whatever progress we're making, it's been slow. And to sum this all up, as they say, the laws of physics are immutable. So to the extent we're succeeding or making progress is somewhat irrelevant because as they say, winning slowly is the same as losing.
I want to ask Lisa a question that builds on this. You know, I heard you say in an interview, Lisa, that when you first started your climate advocacy, you learned quickly that sharing information with people doesn't necessarily turn them into advocates or change their minds, you know, and that does seem to be a frustration that we're all encountering in this work where we have a lot of really voluminous reports. The science is quite solid, but people still either because they are in a comfort zone that they don't want to leave or because they're scared, perhaps, often don't shift their behaviors when confronted with this. And I just wonder from a psychological perspective, you know, what insights you have about what does it take? What do you have to add to these reports to get people to say, okay, to accept a hard message and really internalize it in a way that leads to change?
I'll try to take it from the top, because what you've just asked could be responded to either in a couple of sentences or volumes. So I will underscore that when I first started looking at climate issues, it was after I'd run for the U.S. Senate here in Maryland. And as Frank Mankiewicz said once after having lost an election, which I obviously did not win, he said, "The people have spoken." "The bastards." You can take that audio out if you want, but I'm just saying that that's what he said. And I do get a quiver of pain when I think about what a leadership role in policymaking could be, and what it means to be persuasive and to understand the psychological underpinnings to our behaviors. So I did start off with Al Gore chose me as one of the first 50. And I honestly just assumed that we would look at the numbers, which we were at 392 parts per million at the time. And I remember hearing that we couldn't go beyond 400. And thinking to myself, well, you know, we'll run the numbers. This was 2006. We'll run the numbers, realize we can't get beyond that, and we'll turn the crank and start seeing the changes that we need to see, because I did not believe that we were so self-destructive. So it was an education, a baptism, I won't say by fire, except to say that it was a slow burn. Because increasingly, of course, over the years, I have seen far from it. And the reality is that we're not just rational beings. And that is the misapprehension about the species. And thinking that we only do reasonable things is the major fallacy and vulnerability. A good deal of what we do in life is based on unconscious factors. People will put the numbers at different points, but people will say 70 to 80% of what we do is driven by unconscious factors. We pick up on body language and tone and things, and we wouldn't even begin to tell you what it was that we just saw and heard. So what happens is that making a rational appeal does work with some people, and we don't have to describe if they're extremely cognitively oriented, but probably more so than the average scientists, et cetera. And so we got a certain percentage of the population to say, oh my God, and start ringing the alarm bell. But the rest of the world, you know, is essentially going like this, don't want to know, don't want to hear, don't want to see, want to have a good time, don't bother me. And I will say that over the years, what I have come to believe is that talking about climate is a little bit like talking about our own mortality, our senescence, that we're going to grow old and eventually die. And just as we don't usually go to a dinner party and talk about what we plan to have at our funeral or how we need to be very careful to avoid certain things so that our funeral isn't premature, we don't want to talk about climate. And that's changing. I remember going to dinner parties and fighting with myself the first few minutes about whether or not I was going to bring up climate. And, you know, I could shut a dinner party down in minutes and everyone would go silent and then go back to their travels or sports teams and things like that. That's changing. So we know that society is changing. We also know, and this is something that I say because I realize that at the end, I'm, after all, a psychiatrist. You can't just pull a person's pants down and then have them leave your office. You got to help them pull them back up. So what I tell people is that despite all of the challenges we have, and the Lord knows we've got plenty, And that we are self-destructive. That is incontrovertibly obvious, very self-destructive. But we see that with our weight, with what we eat, with not putting money away, with how we drive. We see this. It's not just climate. But we, despite all of this, there are climate tipping points, of course, but there are also social tipping points. And I will say that I have seen that I can no longer shut a dinner party down, but rather can spark a conversation. Now, they're still talking a lot about their travels, and airplane travels included and everything else, but we are getting traction. So the stories, you said, what really gets people? Data is a very cognitive approach. And what moves people to action is when you reach their hearts. So 6 million can be a statistic. A single person can be something that stops you dead in your tracks. And so talking to people about personal issues, talking to people about what you have seen and what is being suffered on a very individual level is something that can turn the crank, because after all, it is our emotional investment that really brings the connection. And we are now learning to tell those stories.
Super helpful. I think that this question of how to narrate data is just in the front of everyone's mind, how to build a narrative that really lands in a place where it retains attention and motivates people to action. And so I'm going to turn the frame to really the topic that we want to focus on, which is very surprising. And I didn't really understand this, David, until you and I talked about it, but focusing on the healthcare sector itself. And I think people, when they hear what you have to say, will be surprised. Really addressing two things. I think number one is the impact of the healthcare sector on contributing to greenhouse gases, and secondly, we could say reluctance or blind spot around engagement in solutions. So, David, frame that for us if you can. I know you have been, this has been the heart of your work for a number of years now.
Sure. So, thank you. So, the U.S. healthcare, you may know, is almost 20% of the GDP. It's $4.5 trillion annually. Even to give you a better sense, it's the largest industry in the largest economy in the world. It happens to be, not surprisingly, very energy intensive. To the extent, on point per your question, the healthcare industry in and of itself emits 500 million tons of greenhouse gases annually. To give you a sense of how much that is, that's the equivalent of burning 553 billion pounds of coal. So the healthcare industry's emissions account for about 9% of total U.S. emissions. Interestingly, however, U.S. healthcare accounts also for 25% of total annual global healthcare emissions. Okay, so the bottom line, U.S. healthcare has a very large carbon footprint. The healthcare industry's emissions alone cause substantial health harm. So relative to mortality, it's estimated that the industry's emissions alone are commensurate with upwards of 100,000 US deaths annually. And since emissions travel globally, you can multiply that by a factor of 3, calculate overseas deaths. But also too, they cause a lot of health harm. In fact, fossil fuel combustion constitutes the largest environmental cause of human mortality worldwide. It's over, to put it in terms, it's more in terms of mortality, it's over one Holocaust, 6 million deaths annually, somewhere about 9 million deaths annually. In fact, in the US, fossil fuel combustion, regardless of who's admitting it, accounts for almost 60% of excess US deaths annually. So again, the healthcare industry has a massive carbon footprint. It starts with hospitals, not surprising. And if you're interested, who's second in the industry, the pharmaceutical industry. Now, per your second question on reluctance, this is really the most actually shocking, appalling aspect to this, is that despite the health and knowingly, I mean, this is well known, health harms resulting from fossil fuel combustions are well-researched, well-known, well-documented. They're innumerable and they're unrelenting, and they affect everybody, everywhere, always. But despite all that, the U.S. healthcare industry, as I've explained, remains nihilistic on reducing their footprint. There's a lot of reasons for that. I could explain those, but I think that's generally true. When it comes to federal healthcare policymakers relative to addressing the healthcare industry's emissions, and here we're talking about congressional legislators and administration regulators, they've been in some hands off. And this is interesting, we're having this discussion because last night, HHS's Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services published the most important annual regulatory rule, which is the IPPS, the Inpatient Prospective Payment System, or how hospitals will get paid for inpatient care. And in that proposed rule, this would be, of course, for 2024, in that 1,500-page proposed rule, there is no mention of either addressing the industry's emissions or, for that matter, improving climate crisis-related healthcare delivery and outcomes. Particularly odd, since not surprisingly, Medicare beneficiaries are disproportionately harmed. In part, the elderly have difficulty thermoregulating, for example, beyond being comorbid. I'll throw in as well, Medicaid beneficiaries also disproportionately harmed, particularly children. Not surprisingly, if you don't know, children actually breathe more air than adults. They have a faster respiratory rate. So needless to say, think of asthma immediately. But the impact is extensive, substantial, and there is this pronounced reluctance to address it.
Can I just say, and can be lifelong, because lung volume when in children who have been exposed to the highly polluted air is diminished. It's one reason why so many rich families are moving out of Beijing. Sorry, go ahead, David. I just couldn't stop myself. These are lifelong impacts.
In fact, I'll just read you to give you a sense to appreciate this, because really, you know, children, of course, vulnerable in so many ways, but there was a research synthesis published in the England Journal a year ago, and I'll just give you an abbreviated list. Okay, harms to children. Beyond respiratory diseases, these include preterm and low weight birth, infant death, hypertension, kidney disease, immune system dysregulation, structural and functional changes to the brain, and a constellation of mental and behavioral health diagnoses. And that's the abbreviated list.
For air pollution? We're just talking about air pollution?
Yes, just for, and in fact, per your point, Lise, it is the case per the World Health Organization that ostensibly everyone on the planet, 99% of people on the planet, breathe substandard air, largely the result of fossil fuel combustion.
May I add cardiovascular impacts? And also just this last, which is a 2.5 micron particulate matter, less than 2.5, is what is usually looked upon as the culprit. But that's a fine particulate matter. But the real problem is ultrafine particulate matter, which crosses the alveolar system in the lungs and directly into the brain. So it goes everywhere in the body. So I start feeling like I got ants in my pants when I start hearing this, because with all the opportunities we have to be smart, here we are leaving them on the table, and this is the healthcare industry.
That's the great irony. I have to ask, and I'm sure people are going to wonder, could you summarize what you see as the top one or two reasons why, and to what extent is it ignorance, and to what extent is it willful, if you could characterize it that way?
Well, I would say there's no ignorance whatsoever. I mean, this is an industry or field where people are highly educated. In fact, my line is these people never take a chemistry class or a physics class, right? So these are highly intelligent people. Couple of reasons. One, first of all, the reason is clearly obvious, political will. I mean, the economics are in favor, meaning the financing are in favor. In fact, kilowatt hour pricing for renewables are cheaper now. So the finance economics are there. The technology is certainly there. The only, what we lack is clearly political will. That's explained in part because, of course, one of the two major parties in this country either doesn't recognize the physics or the science reality or working actively counter to undermine it. The Democrats share substantial blame equally to the extent that, say, for the last two Congresses, the 116th Congress, which was a marginal majority in the Senate, but still a majority in both chambers, they did nothing. This last Congress, 117th, they did nothing. Obviously, this Congress is divided, so you'll see very little. The Biden administration, where they promised January of 21, this was going to be an all-government issue, as I noted, regulatorily, HHS, specifically CMS, the last two regulatory cycles for regulatory year 22 and 23 did nothing. And it looks like for 24, they're not going to propose anything. So on the regulatory side, the D's have been equally inept.
So to sharpen this, we know we're dealing with a system that is heavily reliant on public dollars. So I think maybe as much as 50% or more of dollars supporting the system is coming from the federal and state government. So that obviously, it seems, could provide a major lever, you know, if it could be utilized to put in some kind of a regime that would move people in the right direction. Yet it seems clear that lever is not being used. Could you shine a light on whether people have attempted that and where is it being blocked?
Well, I'm sure you've heard this before. This is the phrase regulatory capture. So the industry is, you know, spends a lot of lobbying dollars, about $500 million. So they have great influence on the Hill. So for example, CMS just backed off on a final Medicare Advantage rule a week or two ago for 2024. So as case in point. So the bottom line is that the administration, current administration, previous administrations, failed to exert their regulatory authority, which, and in fact, I published a piece a couple years ago where I argued that the Secretary of HHS, Becerra, could tomorrow publish an interim final rule and require providers under conditions of participation, and everybody needs to participate in Medicare, because as you noted, it's the market maker, and who's gonna, you know, dismiss, you know, 60 million potential patients, right? It's a huge market. You can't look past it. So he could pass an interim final rule saying, if you're gonna continue to participate in the Medicare program, you have to meet conditions of participation, and we're gonna revise those to say, not only do you have to publicly report your emissions, but you have to publish also a plan to reduce your emissions in the appropriate time period. Again, they could do that. Now, of course, it would be legally challenged, no surprise, but they do have that legal authority regulatorily to do that. It's difficult to believe. Medicare, Medicaid is $1.5 trillion annual spend. Again, being the market maker, they could certainly do this. But again, it's down to political will.
So let me shift the question back to Lisa now. And I really want to, ask this, frame this in this way, that we here we have an audience of people involved in healthcare. Presumably, they are, going to be more motivated on this issue than the average person because they've dedicated their lives to the health and well-being of people and communities. We have to believe that they're bringing a positive attitude toward the case, you know, and yet they're not engaged or not effectively engaged yet. And I'm really thinking about the work that you've done in terms of, you know, looking at also the impact of these climate issues on mental health. So you've got the mental health plus the physical health. And what you said earlier about narratives and how to frame, you know, what is, I think, as David said, well known in terms of narratives. Is that a pathway towards engaging this system? Because 20% of greenhouse gases, that's a significant impact. So this seems like a huge opportunity zone. And I guess my question is, between the two of you, what is it that could be done to really get this across the goal line?
Well, clearly there is not a one size fits all answer to that question. David and I certainly agree that it's political leadership that is wanting, and without stressing overly the root components, you know, you've got in Congress people, no offense to lawyers, my father was a lawyer, my husband's a lawyer, my sister, my daughter, et cetera. There's nothing wrong with lawyers, but they're really not trained in science. And so we do not have enough people who really understand science, and that it's not just a paid position to take one side or the other or to be politic. We need advocates. We need persuasive people who, after all, are spending a lot of time chasing money to stay in power. So we will not talk about the impact of money, obviously, on our politics. And how we choose our political officials. But of course, it is because we do not have people who are equipped, and that can be a word writ large, to make the decisions that are necessary to keep us safe and healthy. So we'll start there. So the system it's a systemic problem that is obviously in play. So what can we do? The other issue is that it is a resistance to change. There's enormous inertia. People tend to make decisions based on what the people around them are doing. And until you reach critical mass, and David has the number, it's like just a handful of hospitals, for example, in the US are ENERGY STAR, energy efficient. Doesn't cost them anything to get ENERGY STAR efficiency, right, David? Or if it is, it's minimal, and you certainly get back what you save in the expense of getting ENERGY STAR, the savings more than the return on your investment is clear. The issue is that, and I also find this in doctors, and for those of you who are listening to this, one of our issues is, darn it, if doctors aren't by nature kind of timid, and, you know, we're worried about making a mistake, and, you know, we don't want to go off, you know, out on a limb. We're used to doing A, B, C, D, or none of the above and making safe, you know, by the numbers. And so getting out into the public domain where we belong now, and particularly mental health professionals in legislatures, demanding to see the governor or the staff, speaking to our elected officials, county councils, wherever we can be, to sound the alarm about what's happening, not only to us generally and to Earth's climate systems, the biosphere and animals, but particularly to the seed corn, our kids. Our kids are suffering. And mental health professionals should be, and I will say should be, now trained to speak publicly about the greatest threat to our survival, let alone our mental health, which, by the way, nothing affects what we do as humans more than our mental health. It affects our economies, it affects our societies, it affects our communities, our families, it affects us individually, it affects our health. Everything that we do as humans is touched by our mental health. And when we know, and particularly young people whom I have seen, who are just outraged at feeling abandoned by the government in action, by government inaction, and the feeling of cynicism about democracy, about their futures, the despair. And we know that suicide rates in between 2007 and 2017 were up 57% in young people. Well, you know, there's a reason. It's not just social media. It's a belief. And any, of course, suicide is very complex. But I hear from kids all the time that it is a belief that the future is not going to be a safe one. It's not going to be a fulfilling one. They don't want to have kids, et cetera. So I have been advocating for our professional organizations to organize subspecialties in climate and mental health so that we can create people who can reach out into communities, learn about community organizing, bring faith leaders in, bring business people in, bring NGOs in, bring people from all different silos to look at creating the resilience that is absolutely critical. But once again, it's absolutely imperative. Once we start doing these things and reach a critical mass, the social norm will take over. But and we're getting closer. I do want to say that, but it is very frustrating to see that people who should know are essentially not comfortable being out in the public space and saying these things.
So, I mean, one of the most exciting things about having you in this dialogue, Lisa, is that you know, you represent part of the healthcare system that's engaged on this issue. So like you are an example in essence of what needs to happen throughout the whole system. Obviously it would seem to me that if the doctors that are inhabiting the system that really make up the system, if they were organized, they could tip the system. And so it's clear that you're doing some really important work in the arena of organizing mental health professionals. I wonder, do you have a counterpart? Are there counterparts in the general, you know, medicine arena who are also engaged on climate action? And do you guys combine forces? Could you talk about efforts to mobilize the professionals in the space on this issue?
Yeah. Efforts are being made. We are making progress. And the AMA has inched its way along, I will say. David laughs. I do say inched. In some hospitals and clinics, and I'm going to call out the Gunderson Clinic in Wisconsin. Maybe everybody already knows I'm from Wisconsin with my accent, but it's not as flat as it used to be. But there are sustainability sectors within medicine. And the Gunderson Clinic in good old Wisconsin has been net zero now for several years. And, you know, there's not a lot of sun and wind in Wisconsin, but it's just by being smart. The Gunderson Clinic has offered help to those hospitals and other medical entities who want to look at being more energy efficient. And so the answer is that every single person who's listening to this today should turn to the organization and the staff and the higher ups and say, do we have a sustainability sector within our organization? And if not, volunteer, make sure though that it isn't just doctors. We want doctors and nurses and health technicians. We want across the board, because the resilience and the buy-in comes when you have a cross-sector collaboration. You can split up and focus laser-like on what you can do specifically, but it's this cross-sector activation that is particularly important. We've got tons of opportunity. And look, I've been a psychiatrist for a long time. If there's one thing I know that will help us to feel a sense of self-worth and that life has meaning, it's when we do things that are constructive, that give us a sense of purpose. So do yourself a favor and do something that will give you this a sense of purpose for the rest of your life, because this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Thank you, Lisa. I think that's inspiring, and I think one of the great insights I had listening to some of the interviews you've given is just this idea that one of the ways to combat the terrible mental health effects of climate, the climate crisis, is to get involved and try to be part of the solution. This is a healthy behavior in essence. And also, because that's a, there's a profound connection between your mental health and your physical health, when you're working on your mental health, you're also improving your physical health, right?
Two-way street.
Together. So that's a powerful idea. David, I want to ask you, like, you're doing this a long time, and so if you're king for a day, like, what do you change? What do you change in the operating environment to make a breakthrough? Where do you see the possibilities for system changing work?
Well, the logic is clearly, you know, as I've said, it's cheaper to save the climate than it is to destroy it. So per the word inertia, yes, absolutely. So if you compare renewable energy prices to fossil fuels, for example, wind and solar is less than $50 a kWh, gas is well north of 50, coal is north of 100. So it's within the self-interest of providers, both financial self-interest or sustainability interests and their environmental sustainability interests. And for example, Lise noted the EPA's Energy Star program, only 4% of hospitals are Energy Star certified. I won't bother going and explaining what that means, but there's a massive opportunity for energy efficiency, mostly because there's a massive amount of energy waste. U.S. hospitals are 2 times more energy intensive than European comparative hospitals, despite any quality difference or better quality outcomes. Relative to mental health, I'd encourage the listeners to look at the recent CDC behavioral health survey data amongst adolescents. It's pretty grim. Relative to lawyers, first I'll say on clinical leadership, there are clinical leaders. There aren't nearly enough, but there certainly are. It's several of the Ivies on the West Coast, Lise mentioned Wisconsin and elsewhere, but they're too few. So on balance, there's a woeful lack of clinical leadership. Since Lise mentioned lawyers, relative to going forward, for good and for bad, and you'll appreciate this from your professional training, David, this is increasingly winding up in the courts. So, for example, right now, before the European Court of Human Rights, there are 2 parties, French citizens and Swiss residents, before the European Court. The UN just passed a resolution to solicit a legal opinion on this issue from the International Court of Justice. In June, there'll be a state case in Montana, Held versus Montana, where children in Montana have filed a civil suit against the state, claiming that their Montana constitutional rights have been violated. There are several other like suits, Virginia, Hawaii, Utah, elsewhere. This is based on the 2015 filed Juliana case. That was a federal court in the Ninth Circuit. So we're seeing a lot of this increasingly in the courts. There is a soon to be published article in the Harvard Environmental Law Review titled, and you can figure out where the authors are going, Climate Homicide, suggesting that the oil and gas companies are guilty thereof. So we're seeing increasing, and there are thousands of other legal cases around the world on this. So I'd have to think that over time we'll see progress made in that realm. But again, relative to the healthcare industry, it's within their own self-interest. And I should mention too, this month we're expecting for the for-profits in the healthcare, the SEC rule about having to account for climate in your financing. And then let's not forget the subnational efforts. There are 40 jurisdictions in this country requiring commercial buildings to reduce their emissions: Boston, New York, Washington, DC, Chicago, and elsewhere. So there's a lot of progress on that front as well.
May I add, thank you, David, just that as far as the 2 cases you mentioned and other legal cases, the Juliana case against the federal government, as well as Held versus the state of Montana, that I am the expert witness on the psychological damages to the kids the plaintiffs in both cases. And those particular profiles of the kids are sealed. But what I can confirm in my work with children, young people generally, is that there is substantial damage and that we are in denial about the extent of the damage. And David's comment about climate homicide, is that the name of the article, David?
Yes, that's the title, yes.
Yeah, well, it's also suicide. Because I got to say, and I'm going to say it right here openly because I've said it to my colleagues whom I work with on the Climate Psychiatry Alliance and Climate Psychology Alliance, everything begins at home. Calculate your own carbon footprint. You can go, Cool California has a great residential, and there are many others. But people don't want to do that because they don't want to know. But if you want to be a good advocate, you better make sure that you know what your carbon footprint is. The last thing you want to know is that you're a hypocrite, because you're not going to be a good advocate. If you understand where the challenges are and how being smart can change your own carbon emissions, you're going to be much better at doing this. My colleagues have a hard time looking inward. This is not just climate homicide. This is a self-destructive part of ourselves that we just don't want to look at. And I will refer once again to the sense that when it comes to the fact that there's a time stamp on our necks from Mother Nature, I think that there's a certain amount of unconscious aggression that we are showing to Mother Nature in our resistance, and an intergenerational justice, or what I've called intergenerational aggression, that is being shown. And this is perhaps unconscious in most of us. We talked about unconscious factors, but this is intergenerational aggression when we leave a world that is uninhabitable for future generations.
It seems to me that as advocates, we have some real work to do also around this idea of long-termism. I don't know if you've heard this expression where, you know, I think one of the challenges we face is that where we have these very complex problems that where the time horizon, it goes off, say, 20, 30 years into the future for the real big impacts to be affected. And people who have enough information and knowledge about the system, it's so easy for people to say, well, I'm not going to be here when that happens. So,
oh, that's the intergenerational aggression.
Yeah, that's right. The discounting. And so it's something that, oh, you know, well, my children are going to have to figure that out. And you're just passing the buck, in essence, which is a great tradition in our politics, to pass the buck in the future.
If I could just quickly say, in my mind, this is not a complex problem at all. You know, the phrase is, and it's accurate, we just need to stop digging the hole.
Right.
And all the technology is there, the financing is there, the economics. We have the Inflation Reduction Act, energy security tax credits that could go upwards of $1 trillion. So it's inertia, it's many things, but we've known the solution for at least 70, 80 years. And I'll say too, the problem is you're right. If you're under 50, certainly under 40, it's beyond worrisome. But the problem is, I mean, I thought I was going to escape this. My own mortality, probably not. It's here now. It's getting worse rapidly every year. The only other thing I would say is, I'll drop the point. Go ahead, David.
No, I think this is really important, I think, because I think you're getting to some of the real nub of why people, you know, don't engage. And one thing I want to say, we are coming to
the end. I'll make the point. Lisa and I have talked about this, and let's not be shy. You know what this week is. 5 years ago this week, David Buckle, right?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Sure. So David Buckle, you'll appreciate this, David, mm-hmm. Brooklyn lawyer, walks into Prospect Park, April of 18, trenches a little hole, pours fuel over himself and self-immolates,
right,
which was repeated on the steps of the Supreme Court 2 years ago. So when Lise talks about psychological effects, and Lise and I have had this conversation on our own cycle, the effects psychologically to ourselves, it's appreciable.
Yeah. Well, you know, so we are coming to the end of our time. I want to ask two very important questions. One is, you know,
let me just stop for 1 second, because it's another directed at my colleagues.
Yeah.
And that is the idea of intellectualization, and that we tend to want to study and do more research. We don't need any more research, as David said. Please do not offer more papers. So you can say it's 37.2, not 35.6. The critical issue now is to turn what we know already into what we do. As a friend of mine said, a coral reef expert said, more research is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic to get a better view. We need action now. Okay, sorry for interrupting, David.
No, it's very appropriate to what I was going to ask, which is, you know, what can any individual do right now to make a difference? And I've heard a few things. I mean, one is obviously you pointed out, Lisa, very important, our own carbon footprint. So we all have control over our own carbon footprint, which is something that can make a difference. I think a lot of people think, well, what, my little drop won't make a difference. But of course, that's the tragedy of the commons. We all have to be part of it. And it comes down to integrity. I think it's a matter of, can I advocate for something that I'm not willing to do myself? So the integrity of changing our individual behavior. But then we have influence over these intermediate institutions. We all have all these institutions around us. Yesterday, you and I were talking about county governments, municipal governments. You know, our local governments are big contributors, and they control things like hospitals. You know, they have influence over these intermediate institutions. So I think what we're saying, if I'm hearing it right, what we're saying is go to those places where you have local influence and make these demands for carbon neutrality, for being mindful about what can be done, and for mobilizing to larger levels of action. You know, so I'm hearing these things. And what else? Am I missing anything? What can somebody listening to this say, okay, I heard the message. This is where I'm going to put my stake in the ground and get involved.
If you're asking me, I call it the 3 or 4 P's: personal, professional, public, and political. And it pretty much covers, I think, what we can do and where we start. We start at home. And by the way, that excuse about what one person does doesn't matter is idiotic, because, of course, what we do is counted collectively. It's like votes on election day. Yeah, what one vote usually doesn't matter, although it did once in the Virginia legislature. Mm-hmm. But those votes are counted together. So it drives markets. It can change dramatically outcomes. So, of course, professionally, we talked about that I won't repeat it because of time. Publicly, anything that you can do anywhere that sets the social norm, that shows other people what the approved of behavior should be now, is something that is key to change those social norms. Again, climate tipping points and social tipping points. We already talked about political. So that, for me, that covers at least the range in this setting, at least.
Thank you. David, anything to add?
Since I'm in D.C., not surprisingly, I would say vote. And I direct that mostly towards people, say, under 35, since they don't show up typically in the numbers. And I would say, lack of a better word, protest.
All right, good one. That's another P. I got 5 now.
Okay. I just to say, when I worked on the Hill, I could not walk by a protest group, regardless of the issue, without turning my back to pretty much everyone else and giving them the thumbs up. You'd be amazed. I'm stunned we don't see more protest on this issue, numerous other issues, of course, but certainly on this issue, because, of course, if we don't solve this issue or this problem, all other problems are moot. This is the meta problem. It underlies all other problems, particularly in healthcare. You can't improve healthcare until when you address this issue. So I would say, don't be shy, protest.
That's great. And so I also wanted to touch on the point of how do you, both of you maintain your resilience and your ability to engage with such challenging work over such a long arc of time. You know, fatigue, burnout, cynicism, these are things that happen to us when we spend a lot of time working on something without necessarily seeing the progress we hope for. So actually, in that spirit, I wanted to read you something that you said, Lisa, which I think landed very well for me. This is from your Sounds True interview. You said, when a person says enough, I'm going to take a leadership role here. I'm going to be involved in collective action. I'm going to put myself in a situation where I'm working with others. Then another part of our brains becomes activated, a part that gives us this transcendent feeling of being part of something bigger. We get away from the narrow specifics of ourselves, and it allows us to feel gratitude. We have a certain sense of humility, and it brings about compassion. Most of all, it gives us a sense of awe of that we have forgotten about, all that we have forgotten about in the narrow. It makes us more generous, gives us a feeling of reducing our sense of our personal needs and importance in favor of the group. That is a magic sauce for spirit. So I thought you kind of nailed it there. And, you know, I want to really encourage people to reach out for your book, because this is a great point that when we get engaged, we're doing something for our mental health, our own mental health and our physical health. So actually, this work can make us stronger. Doing this work can make us stronger. What else?
Well, yeah, do yourself a favor. Get involved.
Amen.
I think we do know that taking action is empowering. That feeling of helplessness, that, you know, as physicians, we've seen people who regress and are unable to take the bull by the horns, and we really have to help them because they don't make good decisions when they've regressed. But it's when we finally tackle a problem that the empowering sense begins to grow and brings us together with others who, because of the collective, and we're social animals, when we're together with others who are like-minded, that's where we can reach our ascendancy and really bring the noblest, the noble angels in ourselves to the fore.
Thank you, Elise. Final thoughts from you, David, anything to add?
I thought of this, I'll tell you quickly. So you mentioned we were Kellogg Fellows. So when I applied 30 years ago, I included in my application the last stanza of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. Most people don't know this, but it's a protest song. And the last stanza, roughly translated as I recall it, is, there in the shadow of the steeple, near the relief office, I saw my people, and I wondered if God blessed America for me. So I went to the inauguration, I walked down 2 winters ago, because I saw it was on the program, I thought, maybe Biden will have them sing the last stanza. Of course, they didn't. So all towards my point again about protesting, it's a protest song. This land is for you and me, and you get the government you deserve.
Amen. Amen. Well, thank you, Dave and Lisa. On behalf of the Alliance, thank you so much for joining our dialogue today. We're going to catch up with you in the future and see how this work is going.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
On behalf of the Alliance, thank you for joining us today for this important conversation. It's our hope that sharing these ideas will open new pathways to effective action supporting the fragile world we share. Thanks also to the Americana Foundation for supporting this series. Find us on the web and get involved with our work at AllianceOfLeadershipFellows.org.